Hello, I'm Ray Reich, founder and CEO of RevOps Squared, and your host of the Metrics That Measure Up podcast. We talk to a wide variety of B2B, SaaS, and cloud thought leaders, executives, investors, and people just like you to discuss the metrics and benchmarks they use to make metrics-informed decisions. Now on to today's show. Welcome to today's episode of the Metrics That Measure Up podcast. Today, we are joined by Bill Reichert, partner at Pegasus Tech Ventures, managing director at the Garage Technology Ventures, and author of Getting to Wow, Silicon Valley Pitch Secrets for Entrepreneurs, and a bestseller on Amazon. In today's episode, we will be covering three main topics: the value of clear, credible, and compelling communications and investor pitches, a pitch deck outline in what not to miss, and presenting versus storytelling to investors. What's the difference? Bill, please take a moment to give a brief background overview of your journey to becoming a guest on the Metrics That Measure Up podcast.
Thank you, Ray, and thank you so much for having me here. I really appreciate it. In any case, the origin of all this goes back to the time when I was an entrepreneur. So when I was an entrepreneur, I was coached that the key to being successful with raising funds was to develop a 56-slide pitch deck with data and evidence and logic and graphics and compelling arguments, like a legal brief for a closing argument in a courtroom, to drive home to the investors that, you know, it was absolutely incontrovertible that you should invest in our company. And then, so I was pretty successful doing that, as it turned out. I started or co-founded or restarted four different startups, two of which wound up going public. And then I wound up becoming a venture capitalist. So I got together with Guy Kawasaki and a few other people, and we started Garage Technology Ventures. And the big idea behind Garage was to be the first venture capital firm that was designed for the benefit of entrepreneurs. We thought that was a radical concept. And what that meant was we wanted to share all of our learnings as entrepreneurs, all of our mistakes, all of our successes with entrepreneurs to help them become more successful. So as part of that, you know, I spent a lot of time coaching entrepreneurs on how to be effective in pitching their startups. And what I discovered is that we as a community had actually been doing damage to entrepreneurs in the way we were coaching them to pitch to investors. So I was trying to figure out what is wrong with these standard approaches to coaching entrepreneurs, you know, these template pitch decks and these sort of standard advice. And I discovered that as a community, we misunderstood the whole idea of pitching. So a few things came out of that. One that we'll talk about is that a pitch is not a presentation. You do not have a fixed amount of time with dedicated attention by the other side to listening or even caring about what you're doing. It's very different than that. The other thing I realized is that investors don't invest with their brains, believe it or not. Investors don't invest with their brains. Investors, like all the rest of us, investors invest with their hearts. And so the secret to being successful reaching out to an investor is not a logical argument with tons of data and tons of evidence. The secret to getting to an investor is to get them to fall in love, to get them to say, wow, that's amazing. Tell me more. Come into my office. Meet my partners. Wow. Wow is an emotional response, right? Wow is not an intellectual response. Wow is an emotional response. And so you've got to figure out how to get the investor's heart beating faster, get their pulse racing, get them excited about what you're doing. And so that's the cornerstone of getting to wow, which is you got to be clear what you're doing. You got to be compelling. You got to get my heart racing, and you got to be credible. You got to get me to believe that what you're saying is true.
So Bill, let's double click in getting to wow, because over your years of seeing hundreds, if not thousands of entrepreneurs making the pitch, you realize that all the data in the world didn't convince you. They had to get to your heart. They had to have that emotional reaction. What was the catalyst though for you to say, instead of telling that to the entrepreneurs I'm coaching, to actually take the time to write a book and help thousands and thousands of aspiring entrepreneurs?
Well, right. So I've been talking about this for, you know, almost 15 years or so. And a few years ago, a friend of mine came to me, Angelica Blenstrup, and said, "Hey, Bill, you know, I keep on hearing you talking about getting to WOW. Would you mind if I sort of collected all your material? There's some blogs and articles and videos and pulled it together for my entrepreneurs." Angelica is a mentor and a pitch coach who works with entrepreneurs, mainly international entrepreneurs coming to Silicon Valley to help them, you know, sort of acculturate to Silicon Valley and be successful here. So I said, sure, go ahead, you know, God bless. So 6 months later, Angelica comes back with like 250 slides that she has pulled from all these different sources, you know, that I've touched over the years and said, look what I got. And so she said, would you help me edit this? And so, you know, then over 2 years, lots of plane flights, writing up all of these pieces and putting it all together and pulling it all together, you know, I thought, okay, fine, Angelica, yeah, let's turn it from me running around talking to entrepreneurs to a actual something that lots of people can share. So that's what got this to happen. So one of the secrets to writing a book is have a co-author who will kick you and nudge you and cajole you and be nice to you and elbow you. You know, the secret to getting a book written is to have a co-author. That's one of the things that I've learned from this.
I find that's very similar in almost all aspects of life, whether it's your spouse as your partner or your co-founder or that person at your company that really inspires and motivates you. So it's good to see that's what got us here today. But one of the things I looked at, you talked about 250 slides and you wrote a book that has over 250 pages. And in Silicon Valley, one of the things I've learned is if you can take the incredibly complex and make it simple, you have a better probability of success. And in your book, you talked about the three C's of communication, which I thought was very simple, but very powerful. Can you provide a little color behind why those are your top three for potential investor communications?
Right, exactly. Well, and so it represents sort of the most important things to be effective at communication. And it also represents the things that most entrepreneurs miss when they are pitching. So, you know, the first one is to be clear. So it's amazing how many entrepreneurs cannot give me a simple one sentence statement of what it is they're doing. So, you know, so many entrepreneurs, somehow they've been coached to say, we're going to empower the future of education, or we're going to disrupt the $3.5 trillion healthcare industry, or whatever, right? You know, they have these highfalutin, exaggerated statements that have actually no content, right? We're going to empower the future of education. What the heck does that mean? But so many entrepreneurs, that's their lead statement. Tell me what you're doing. Be clear what it is you're doing. Because if I don't understand what you're doing, how can I get excited about it, right? So you can go off, and this is sort of another complaint that I have that I coach entrepreneurs. Don't start with the problem. Every pitch coach says, start with the problem. And so, you know, these entrepreneurs, I got this email from this entrepreneur who started out with COVID has been a significant issue in the economy and health and blah, blah, blah. And so they go on, there's a paragraph about COVID. You know, okay, I know COVID's a problem, guys. I get it. Tell me, what are you doing, right? You know, somewhere way down in the email, finally, they tell me they're going to help fines for hospitality workers. Oh my God, are you kidding me? Why are you starting with COVID, right? So in any case, the point is, just give me a simple sentence to tell me what the heck you're doing. And I coach entrepreneurs, it's not some exaggerated, hyperbolic, disruptive, revolutionary, curve jumping, blah, blah, blah. What's the sentence that a good journalist would use to clearly and accurately describe what it is you're doing? Just tell me that sentence, right? So that's be clear. The second is be compelling. So this is the whole point about getting my heart beating faster, getting my pulse racing, getting to wow. What is your compelling value proposition to whom? So you tell me, you know, one of my favorite examples, this entrepreneur came up to me and said, Bill, we can accelerate data analytics by a factor of 100x on the same hardware. Whoa, right? Okay, 100x. If you can quantify the degree to which your benefit is greater than anyone else's for your target customers, then that's compelling. And that gets me to say, wow. So give me something compelling. And that should be a value proposition for your target customers that makes it clear to me as an investor that your solution is going to be incredibly valuable to your target customer audience, which, you know, has to do with your likelihood of success, right? So that's be compelling. And then the third is you got to be credible. So God bless entrepreneurs. You know, they are pathologically optimistic. They have to be pathologically optimistic, otherwise they wouldn't be entrepreneurs. You know, it's a crazy idea to think that you can put a dent in the universe, that you could change the world. But God bless entrepreneurs, right? They have this pathological optimism. Sometimes that pathological optimism leads them to, how shall we say, exaggerate a little, maybe, you know, be a little bit hyperbolic. We're going to disrupt the $3.5 trillion healthcare industry. Probably not. Okay, that's all right. So give me some evidence that what you're saying is indeed unique and different and true. So the young entrepreneur who said, we can accelerate data analytics by 100x using the same hardware, you know, my first reaction was, I don't believe you. And then she came back to me and she said, well, we proved it last summer with Major League Baseball in a proof of concept beta test. Boom. We got her into our office. We got a PhD in, and like that, boom, she got a meeting in our office because she gave me evidence that established her credibility. And so, you know, you got to be clear. That addresses the head part, right? So I have an intellectual understanding of what you're doing and I can repeat it back to my partners in the office. You got to be clear. Be compelling, get my heart beating faster, you know, get my pulse racing, get me to say, wow, that's amazing, get me excited, and be credible. Be credible means you pass the gut check, right? We all have a gut level instinct. In the first few seconds, anytime we meet someone or hear something, we all, as human beings, we know we're wired this way. We have a gut reaction to everything new that we encounter. And you got to get through the gut check. You got to be credible. And so be clear, address the logic, be compelling, get my heart beating faster, be credible, pass the gut check. Make sure that you do not come across as a pathologically delusional entrepreneur.
But Bill, let's double click on credible. Sure. Because a lot of these entrepreneurs are, you know, amazing technologists, PhDs, or deep industry expertise. And part of credibility is they want to show you how broad and deep their expertise is. And I think you call that the curse of expertise in your book. What do you mean by the curse of expertise?
Well, the main aspect of the curse of expertise is that as an engineer or a PhD or whatever your background or even your general entrepreneur, you are so deeply, deeply, deeply involved in what you're doing that it's hard for you to appreciate that people who are new to what you're saying are not as familiar with all of the aspects of the business as you are. And so for entrepreneurs who are deeply involved in their technology or deeply involved in their business model, it's hard for them to understand the gap between their understanding of the business and the technology and an investor's understanding. So there's a gap there that is frequently very hard for entrepreneurs to cross. And so what we encourage entrepreneurs is to make sure that they test their messaging with some fresh brains, with some other people who are not as deeply involved in the technology or the business or the product. Test it with some fresh brains to make sure that they're not being too technical or too esoteric or assuming understanding that is not obvious to someone who's coming fresh to it. And so that is the curse of expertise. That's the problem that PhDs have talking with lay people because they don't appreciate how the difference between their understanding and the new person's understanding. So the result is that for many, many entrepreneurs, their pitch is not clear because they make assumptions about the ability of the investor to understand what they're doing without making it clear and simple. And it may not be credible because they assert sort of the capability of their technology, which may or may not be easy for someone who is not a PhD to understand. One of my favorite examples, this happens on a repeated basis. You get a scientist in the room who's pitching their science, right? It could be engineering, technology, whatever. And they will show, for example, and they'll put up on the screen two pictures, two electron microscope images of something to do with their technology, whether it's material science or life science or biopharma or whatever. They'll put these two slides up side by side and they'll gesture to these two slides and they'll say, yes, see? You know, we're sitting there in the conference room looking at these two slides. And I mean, we can tell that the images are different, but we can't tell why the difference has any meaning or has any value. And it's like, well, of course, if you were an experienced pathologist, it would be obvious to you the difference between these two slides. But none of us are experienced pathologists. We're not going to understand it.
It's like on TV when they show me the UK version of the COVID virus and the South African, it looks the same to me, right?
Exactly right. So the PhDs understand it, but most VCs do not have that depth of experience to appreciate the difference.
Well, I'm going to do what a lot of great entrepreneurs have done, and I'm going to pivot a little bit, Bill.
Okay.
And we went from the high level to three C's of communication.
Yep.
But I hit a section of your book, and it was that about, you said, here's what the optimal pitch deck outline is.
Okay.
And it was chock full of so many great examples. I saw examples from Airbnb's initial pitch, and I saw Uber. But you highlighted 15 core slides that every pitch deck must have. Are there one or two kind of slides or sections of an initial pitch that you see entrepreneurs either missing or not including?
So, you know, I appreciate that question. And what I'll tell you is that the problem with most entrepreneurs is not that they forget to include a slide. The problem is they put stuff in there that is either wrong or unnecessary. That's actually the main problem. So, you know, the good news for entrepreneurs now is that there are tons of templates out there, right? So if you have sort of any degree of sort of compulsion about being good at entrepreneurship, you've done enough research to know that there are bunches and bunches of templates out there that have all these topics that you should address. So one of the things that we were sort of nervous about was suggesting that we had the template that is the right template for every entrepreneur. And so in fact, you know, we sort of emphasize in the book that there is no template that is the right template for any entrepreneur. And when you get a template, when you get a list of, we refer to it as the core slides, use it as a guideline, don't use it as a template. Don't just take our 15 slides and put those 15 titles on 15 blank PowerPoint slides and fill them in and think that you have a perfect pitch deck. Every company is different. And the difference is that every startup company has a different sequence and priority of challenges that they need to address. And so your pitch deck should reflect the key challenges you need to address. So it could be proving the technology works. It could be proving that there are customers out there that actually want your product. It could be proving that you have a marketing model that is repeatable and scalable. It could be getting through the FDA or some other regulatory compliance requirement. You know, it could be raising capital. I mean, so every company is different. And so what we want to hear as investors is that you have a clear understanding of the sequence and priority of your challenges and that you present your company that way. So the typical slide deck might have the competitive slide as slide number 7, right? The template says it's slide number 7. But it may be that as soon as you open your mouth, most investors say, oh my God, you know, not another ride-sharing app. Don't they realize that the world is full of ride-sharing apps? And if you don't address that until slide number 7, then the investor is not going to be listening to you for the first 6 slides, right? So you need to address the obvious issues for your company early so that you preempt the investor skepticism around what you're doing. So my point is, here are 15 core slides. It may be indeed that there's some other topics you have to address that we didn't address in the 15 core. There may be some aspect of the challenge that you face that is not even included in that 15. You start by saying, what are the key challenges we face and what's the sequence in which we have to knock them down? And within the context of these are the topics an investor wants to hear about, sequence your pitch accordingly. And then the other thing we try to make clear in the book is that a lot of the pitch coach advice is just plain wrong in terms of these templates that are given out. So one of the things that most every entrepreneur includes, but they do it the wrong way, is a slide on the market. So most every pitch deck, most every template says those VCs, those greedy VCs, they want a unicorn. And so you've got to show that you've got a really big market. And so every entrepreneur, they go out there and they Google the keywords associated with their business and they find some source that says the market for fashion is $860 billion a year. And so they've got a business that has some component of fashion to it. And so they say our TAM is $860 billion. And it's a baloney number, right? It's a totally fake number. So investors don't want you to put some bogus TAM number in your deck. What we want is for you to show not what the market size is, but what the market opportunity is. So, you know, the size is whatever some research service says is the current size of the market today. I'm fine if you're going after a $0 billion market. If what you can do is show that starting with a $0 billion market, you can exploit an opportunity to acquire customers and create a billion-dollar company. So that means that you really, really understand who your target customers are, what your compelling value proposition is, how you're going to connect them, you're going to reach those customers, you're going to touch them, you're going to convert them, you're going to support them, you're going to upsell them, and create a big, successful business. So that's what investors want to hear, not, you know, the healthcare market in the United States is $3.5 trillion. Who cares? That's not a relevant number to an investor. So market size is always misunderstood by entrepreneurs. The other thing that frequently gets misunderstood, I already talked about, is that most entrepreneurs, they start with the problem. If you just tell us what you're doing and you tell us what your compelling benefit is, almost certainly we know the problem you're solving. Right? So it's really hard for me to imagine a company that tells me what they're doing and what their compelling value proposition is, where I'm not going to understand what problem they're solving. Because a benefit statement is actually the solution to a problem, presumably, right? So if you come and tell me we cure cancer, I don't need you to tell me that cancer is a problem. So just tell me what you're doing and what your compelling value proposition is. And then you don't have to have a bunch of slides on what the problem is. We don't need to know, you know, how big a problem COVID is. We don't need to know how big a problem pollution is or climate change is or abandoned shopping carts. We don't need to know that data. We just need to know what you can do to build a big company.
You know, Bill, I think this is the perfect opportunity to transition to something else that you cover in the book. And that is, right, you've got all this great data, but what you want to do is you want to tell that potential investor a story, not just the data. So you can tell me a little bit what the difference is between a great story pitch versus a presentation?
Well, okay. So standard pitch coach advice is tell a story. And what we're saying is for the most part, pitch coaches get this wrong. That when you coach someone to tell a story, generally people think in terms of the Odyssey, right? Homer's Odyssey, right? You know, it could be the foundation story of your company, or it could be some story about how you came across this technology or something like that. That's not the right story to tell. So what we are coaching entrepreneurs in the book is don't come in and sort of typically the poorly coached entrepreneurs, they come into our office, they put up their title slide and they say, you know, before I talk about the company, let me tell you a story, because some pitch coach said, tell a story. And they go on for 3, 4, 5 minutes about the origin story of the company, you know, about how their uncle had done this and had discovered this and they learned at their uncle's knee and blah, whatever it is, right? Something like that. And this is the difference between a pitch and a presentation. So if you sort of follow the TED Talk story arc idea, if you're being coached to give a presentation like a TED Talk, then those coaches will say, start with some element of a story, and then you have this arc across 16 minutes, where at the end of the TED Talk, you sort of pull this thread together and sort of wrap up the story, because we all know, and it's absolutely true, that humans can retain the idea of a story better than we can retain a random assortment of data. And so that's the rationale for the idea of storytelling. But when you're pitching, you've got to tell stories in 30-second sound bites. You know, you do not have 16 minutes to tell your story. Your audience is not obligated to be sitting there and paying attention to you for 16 minutes the way they are when they're sitting in the auditorium at a TED conference, right? So what we're coaching entrepreneurs to do is to figure out how to embed the elements of their company in these very short stories. So one method of sort of telling a story or painting a picture, the idea of telling a story is to paint a picture in the mind of the listener of the context of your technology, your customer, your value proposition, whatever it is, right? So one way to tell a story is to start a sentence with imagine if, right? Imagine if you had a device that replaced kerosene lanterns and delivered better light cheaper than the use of a kerosene lantern. Then you would avoid the smoke, the expense, the risk of fire, the healthcare problems associated with kerosene lanterns. And so that's the story behind a company called Delight Design that was able to replace kerosene lanterns with solar rechargeable LED lanterns. And they've done phenomenally well because the images associated with the stories around their business are so compelling. It's so easy and compelling to appreciate the value that they are giving to their customers. So if you can tell stories in these very short sort of bites and implant these images in the mind of the listener of the customer and the value that gets delivered and the way in which the product is used and the delight that customers have because of the outcome, that's the way to tell a story. Not Homer's Odyssey, not TED Talk. It's these images that you create when you're talking about your company. That's the way to get the message across.
And interesting, Bill, you said this earlier in our conversation about getting to the heart. A key part of storytelling that I saw you highlighted was to evoke an emotion. Right. That investors, even though they want the data, you want to engage them emotionally. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. Right. And so much of value proposition is around your customers realizing a benefit. And that benefit could be life-changing. Or the flip side of it is the sort of emotional aspect of a value proposition can be that right now I have to spend even an IT play, right? So obviously, if you're curing cancer, obviously, if you're solving the climate crisis, you know, it's kind of easy to create emotion around what you're doing. But what if you're an IT company, right? You have a software application. How do you get emotional? How do you evoke emotion around that? Well, you can tell the story of the customer workers who used to spend 6 hours out of the day sort of keying in data in terms of fleet activity and performance. And now, thanks to your software, instead of spending 6 hours a day keying in data to do data analytics, instead, what they're doing is automatically generating analytics and then optimizing the fleet. you know, causing everybody to be happier and more successful and more profitable. Now, I mean, that's not curing cancer, but there is an emotional component that everybody can relate to of changing the life of a worker from drudgery to being sort of a successful analyst, consultant, problem solver. That's what we try to get entrepreneurs to frame their value proposition.
We're going to have to take this home, Bill. And this is okay. The Metrics That Measure Up podcast. And one of the 15 core slides you talk about in that investor pitch deck is financial projections. So if you're out there pitching an investor for either a seed round or a Series A, are there some metrics or unit economics or specific financial metrics that you're saying has to be in this pitch and make sure you know how you calculated them?
Yes. And so it all goes back again to this value proposition question. So somehow you are promising that you're going to deliver this compelling value proposition to these target customers, right? And so the whole idea of this business is that you're going to be reaching out to prospective customers and you're going to touch them and you're going to convert them and you're going to get them to pay and you're going to get them to upsell, right? That's most business models have those components. So what we are looking for in any company is that they can build a repeatable, scalable marketing and sales engine. So, you know, as an investor, the sort of two things that are most critical to our success and to the company's success are speed and efficiency, right? Speed and efficiency. And speed and efficiency both come from building a repeatable, scalable marketing and sales engine. And so the metrics that go into speed and efficiency are, you know, on the speed side, what we want to know is the sales cycle. So depending on the business, if you're a consumer, it's really about sort of conversion rates. It's how many, whatever, downloads can you get for freemium, and then how do you convert? But for enterprise, for SME and enterprise, sales cycle is a much more significant issue in terms of how long does it take between the time that you touch a prospect and qualify that prospect to the time you close, onboard, get payment, et cetera, and then upsell. So there's the sales cycle. We want to know that they are instrumenting their business in such a way that they have a really good visibility on the sales cycle. And then within the sales cycle, you've got, so that's speed. The other side is efficiency, right? So within that sales cycle is the cost to acquire customers. So this is your standard unit economics CAC number. How much does it cost you to get from that first qualified prospect through convert, onboard, and paying customer, right? So that's the cost to acquire. And of course, then the flip side of that is the long-term value of that customer. So that ratio of long-term value to CAC is something we want to see no matter what the business, right? So we associate LTV to CAC with SaaS businesses, but no matter what the model of the business, there is some aspect of those economics that are going to be relevant. And then the related part is we want to see, you know, the other part of efficiency is we want to see good margins, you know, and we want those margins to be improving over time. Obviously, that margin relates to LTV. And so that's how it connects to the LTV CAC ratio. But at the end of the day, as investors, the efficiency has to do with how much capital is it going to require to build this company. So we want the company to be capital efficient in terms of being able to create value over time. And ultimately, speed relates to efficiency. The faster, the better. But too fast could mean a lack of efficiency. So we have seen that model happen a lot, where you get VCs putting so much money into a company that the company is essentially buying revenue, paying $2 to get $1 of revenue. That is a model for accelerating a company. As an investor, I don't love that model. That's not particularly the way we want to do business. We want to see capital efficiency, and we want to see good economics alongside. So broadly speaking, those are the kinds of numbers that we're looking for in analyzing the financial projections of a company.
That's great insight, Bill. And I would say for our audience, one of the first things that Bill talked about around customer acquisition costs, there's a couple metrics we'd strongly recommend you become familiar with, and that's your customer acquisition cost payback period. How long does it take you to pay back with a gross margin adjusted number? Know your CAC ratio, which is how much dollar of sales and marketing spends for every dollar of revenue or ARR. That's customer lifetime value to CAC ratio that Bill mentioned. The other thing that we recommend for companies who have more of a subscription business model, Bill, is you need to make sure that your gross dollar retention and your net dollar retention numbers are based on some reality of your like customer cohort and not looking at Twilio and say, oh, my net dollar retention is going to be 140%. Would you agree that those are important too?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that flows right back to the LTV, right? Because your LTV is highly dependent upon your net dollar retention. But absolutely, that is a separate metric that we expect companies to be looking at. Both, you know, your point, if it's an early stage company, you don't have a lot of data on that. So you're making an assumption. We want that assumption to be realistic. If it's growth stage company, they should have some data. And so we should be able to see that the company has indeed been instrumenting their business in such a way to be collecting that data so that they have a defensible assumption in their projections for their net dollar retention. So Bill, very good point. Very good point.
Yes. We just talked about data. And actually, that goes against one of your pieces of advice is tell a great story that evokes emotion. So can we wrap up? Do you have a story about an entrepreneur or something you've seen that would evoke some emotion to our listening audience of why they need to read Getting to Wow and why they need to understand how to tell emotion-evoking stories?
Yeah. Well, so let me correct a misimpression that you seem to have that somehow data cannot be emotional. Which is to say, you know, I will tell you that, again, the entrepreneur who came up to me and said, we can accelerate data analytics by a factor of 100x on the same hardware, I got emotional, I'll tell you. So don't misunderstand the concept of emotion. Emotion is not about babies and saving lives. I mean, though, yes, that can generate emotion. But my initial point, wow, is not an intellectual response. Wow is an emotional response. And so telling some story about saving somebody's life is not the only way to get an emotional response. If you can show that you can make bits do something that bits have never done before, you can get somebody to go, wow, that's amazing. So I'll tell you, pitch the other day, a 3D printing technology company. 3D printing technology company that is absolutely changing the paradigm for additive manufacturing. And what they have been able to do that nobody else on the planet has been able to do is to print on metal powder with a block at a time rather than a laser at a time. So they can block print metal. And so that can accelerate 3D printing by a factor of between 10x and 50x and can reduce the cost, you know, can reduce the cost by over 90%. Right. And so your reaction is, wow, this is all data. This is not some fluffy story. This is data, right? And so, yes, you have to have an emotional response, but an emotional response can come by having something absolutely amazing that you have been able to accomplish and be able to prove. So my whole point is, wow is an emotional response. And there's a whole bunch of ways you can get to wow without necessarily having to save lives or without sort of the traditional imagery around storytelling. Does that make sense?
Bill, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you wrapping up this episode of the podcast with telling me how we can take data plus emotion and get to wow. To me, because I talk data all day long, and the fact that I can evoke emotion with the right data, I loved it. Thank you so much.
Good. Glad it got across. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for letting me be here today.
Well, that's a wrap to today's episode of the Metrics at Measure Up podcast. And if you're enjoying our guest and the topics we discuss, we would really appreciate if you would subscribe to our podcast and provide us your commentary and rating on how you viewed the podcast. Thank you so much and have a great day, everyone. Thank you for listening to today's Metrics to Measure Up podcast. If you would like to learn more about B2B SaaS metrics and benchmarks, please visit RevOpsSquared.com.